if countries have committed to it, then definitely I hope that we are taking more and more action, especially on SDG 5 and the ones around climate, because I think those are some of the ones on which the least amount of progress have been made.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm delighted with today's guest who introduced herself. Boshali, please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Maurice, for inviting me to the podcast today. I'm very happy to be here. And hello, everyone, to whoever's listening in. My name is Boshali Chatterjee. I work in Christian Aid as the Global Gender Justice Thematic Advisor. I'm based in India, in the southern part of the country, in a city called Bangalore. And in terms of introducing me, I identify myself as an intersectional feminist. I have over 2 decades of work experience in the field of women's rights and gender equality. And I would love to share some thoughts about the work that I'm doing in Christian Aid and anything else that kind of catches my fancy. So thank you, Maurice.
Yeah, and that would be wonderful. And originally we had hoped that we would have been able to talk with each other during CSW 68. That was not possible. So I'm happy that we are connecting now through this way, Boshali. I know that my listeners are interested in is where did you grow up, and how did that maybe inform or not inform who you are, the work that you're doing today. Of course, it informed, who you are today. So can you tell a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure.
Your upbringing. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Maurice. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm currently living in India. I mean, I've always lived in India, but I'm living in the southern part of the country now, but I was born in the eastern part of the country in a city called Calcutta. The reason why I kind of moved to this type of work probably has got a lot to do with the way I was brought up. Mm-hmm. So, when I was growing up, I grew up in a house full of books. My father was a journalist and a writer, and my mother was a teacher of English in a government school. So we had this, and my father had a big library of his own where I was encouraged to spend more time, because for my father, more than my school education, development of critical thinking and analysis was something much more important than sort of the bookish knowledge that your formal education gives you. So he always encouraged me to spend time in his library, and he has an even bigger collection of books now. So I basically grew up reading whatever I could lay my hands on. And I think books were my kind of first introduction to the reality of life around me. And of course, growing up in South Asia, even though you grow up in a privileged middle class household, but you are not too distant or too far away from the sort of the daily gender discrimination that you see in your own life, but also a lot of it around you. You read about it in the newspaper. The books really tend to influence you. So I would say that kind of set me thinking. And primarily, I was always concerned with the question of inequality in terms of why, some people would have so much and some people would have so little. And I was especially sort of moved by the plight of children when I was growing up. I would also like to mention the influence of South Asian feminist writing in developing my consciousness. Mm. And in particular, I think I was about 30, just entering my adolescence, when I chanced upon the work of a Bangladeshi author, Taslima Nasreen, who now lives in exile. And to be able to read her writing in my own language sort of really created this whole other consciousness in me about gender inequality, about women's rights, how women were treated differently, etc., etc. So I think that really triggered my interest. And of course, then I sort of kept on reading. I started writing here and there a bit. And then gradually then chose to sort of, you know, when I started, I mean, after I completed my graduation, I chose to do my master's from Tata Institute of Social Sciences in Bombay, another city in India. And there, I think, kind of my sort of my proper introduction to feminist thinking was born, I would say. And then from there, and of course, there was no looking back. And I kind of consciously decided to work on this field. And after that, kind of every job I have had has then really sort of, what's the word to use? Like helped me sort of increase or my conviction that this is the kind of work that I am meant to do. So I have spent the last 20 years in various roles, starting from a very small grassroots organization to my current global role. But my area of work and interest and passion has always been around gender equality.
Mm. And Bushali, thanks for that. When I was listening to you, you said, you know, when you were growing up, you were observing inequalities in society. Can you still remember maybe the first time or one of the first times you realized this? Is there a memory around it that you can share?
Memory, okay. Let me think back. So, of course, I cannot say that in my household I was treated very differently. But, you know, there are expectations of you sort of being raised as a girl and you know, asked to behave in a certain way that fits into the sort of the notion of the gender norms of how a girl or an adolescent girl, a young woman is supposed to behave. I think all of us kind of grow up within those norms of our behavior, attitude, how we portray ourselves across to the outside world. You know, girls are kind of brought up not to be too outspoken or too aggressive, but to be within certain limits. And there are always different sets of rules for boys and girls. You know, you have to be back home within a certain time of the day. You cannot go out wearing certain type of clothes. All of us growing up in our part of the world have faced sexual harassment in public transport, for example. We've all dealt with it. I mean, you know, like instances of being groped in crowded public transport, or you know, you are walking down the road and you are badly sexually harassed. We even have a term in India called eve teasing for that. So I mean, you are kind of always reminded by other people that who you are and what is the place that you belong to. And sort of you are then told to modify your own behavior so that you do not attract too much attention, or you do not attract harassment, or you do not you do not portray yourself as someone who's kind of stepping outside her limits. So I think all of that is kind of ingrained into your head. And of course, also the fear of the dark and going out by yourself in the night. I mean, Kolkata it's still considered one of the safer cities in India. But I have had very bad personal experiences in terms of feeling really, really unsafe. And so therefore, you know, it's become such a part of my psyche that even when I'm abroad in a different city, I always carry that fear of, you know, isolated places, dark corners inside my head. So yeah, I mean, it's that all these different experiences really shape you. And also the whole thing of care work and how young girls and women are expected to take on the role of the caregiver, the nurturer. You know, it's just an expectation or an obligation that you are automatically fulfilled. So, you know, you are kind of Simone de Beauvoir said, that you are sort of made into a woman because of these norms. So, yeah, I would say that I would be speaking for a lot of us there, that mm-hmm. that's how we were sort of conditioned or gendered into being the kind of sort of women that we were.
And Bushali, if you look at when you grew up and then you studied and then you started, you know, you kind of rolled into this work, I think first for a smaller NGO, and I looked at your bio, then later with organizations like ActionAid and Oxfam, and now ChristianAid. When I meet with, women, young women, older women from India, during the CSW, the Commission on the Status of Women, I see a lot of vocal, you know, determined women that are, you know, fighting for their rights and, you know, standing up. So that is for me encouraging. Has that resulted in changes within India? You know, if you compare it when you grew up and where you are now.
I think so, because I think to start with, when I was in college or when I was in university at the Tata Institute of Social Sciences for my master's, and now when I look back, I see a huge change. And I also keep discussing this with my friends that, you know, the young women we have there are so much more aware of their rights, conscious of their rights. They are not ready. They are so less ready to take on, whatever the world throws at them. They are so ready to challenge. I think there's been a huge, huge change in terms of how women, young women have stood up and said that, you know, this cannot go on anymore. And I saw that especially during the Me Too movement that happened a few years ago. And it's only young women from places that I have studied in or people I know have studied in stood up and said that, you know, this kind of behavior is unacceptable. And I remember telling my friends that when we were there, that kind of behavior was normalized. So we didn't really think of it as, you know, sexual harassment, because we just did not have those lenses. It just did not occur to us. It was so normal and part of everyday culture. But you know, those women, it's really admirable that, you know, they are stepping up and they are saying that, no, this cannot go on, and they are calling out bad behavior. So I think it's a huge change. And I actually also see a lot of that in my son, like, you know, how he's 12 and when I was growing up and how he's growing up. Maybe it's because of the sort of the exposure to social media, but his awareness of the world is very, very different than, you know, when I was his age. Like, you just cannot compare how much more, you know, well aware and in tune with the world he is right now, and has opinion on everything. So I would say, like, things have really progressed a lot in that sense.
Right. So you mentioned to us that books were very important in your life. Okay, let us do a quite side step. Is if I ask you right now on the spot, like, you know, listeners, this week you need to read this book, what book would you recommend?
Oh my God, there are so many. Unfortunately, I don't think those have been translated, or they are not that well known outside of my language, which is Bengali. But mm-hmm. I would recommend, if you allow me, I'll recommend more than one. I think I'm going to first, I'll start with Tagore. The first Asian to win literature in Nobel Prize in literature in 1913, and he's right.
Chidi Gochini, Otomare.
Oh yeah, yeah, huh? You're very familiar already. Hey. But I hope
people... he's longing for his loved one overseas.
Yeah. So yeah. I hope more people are inspired by you, Morris, and read him. But I mean, he continues to be a huge influence over, you know, our people, our Bengalis. But one particular story I would recommend is called The Wife's Letter or Stri Potro, where a wife is actually sort of writing a letter to her husband explaining why she needs to leave him and leave the household and just go away. And I think it was written probably, what, maybe 100 years ago or 70, 80 years ago, maybe. But it still gives me goosebumps when you sort of read it, and the kind of feminist consciousness the story displays, I think, is fantastic. Then, of course, there is a book called Dahon by a Bengali author called Suchitra Bhattacharya. So it means the burning. Again, I was in my teenage years, and the book kind of just, I mean, I can't explain the impact it had on me. About a woman who stops a molestation from happening, and then what happens to her, like the one who stops it from taking place, and how she questions her place in the world. Then a couple of other books by this another Bengali author called Ashapurna Devi, where she has a whole trilogy about women accessing, first generation women who want to go to school and not get married, and the struggles that they underwent. So that whole trilogy, Shottoboti and Pratham Pratishruti, and the third one, Bokul Katha. So I think all three of them have to be read one after another. Yeah, so I think those would be my recommendations.
Okay, great. The listeners will be busy this coming weeks. That's awesome. Thanks for that. Before I ask you to explain a bit more about your work at the moment for Christian Aid, I'd like to go back to when you introduced yourself, when you said, I am an intersectional feminist. What does that mean?
Yeah, so basically, you know, my primary identity is that of a feminist. And when I say that, I mean that I recognize the intersections of the different identities that kind of coalesce and create different forms of vulnerability or marginalization for different groups. And that's really important because, you know, we none of us are, you know, single identity people. So, you know, I am from India, but I'm also of a particular ethnic group. I have been educated in a certain kind of places. I speak English. I am from an upper caste family in the South Asian context, but I'm also a woman. So all of these identities kind of, you know, make me who I am. And, you know, when we are doing a feminist analysis, we have to be very, very mindful of how and if and how these merge and create different forms of vulnerabilities that can sort of hinder my access to human rights. So I think one really has to be mindful of the question of intersectionality and what that then means of that particular context.
Okay, thank you, Ushali. You are Christian Aid's Global Thematic Advisor on Gender Justice. Can you maybe explain, you know, what that entails or what you're working on? Which would be of interest to the listeners.
Maybe I can start with CASW, because you also mentioned mm-hmm. that we were part of the Christian Aid delegation at CASW, and one of the key things that we were bringing to the CASW space was, of course, you know, as part of being in solidarity with ACT Alliance and the Progressive Faith Voices, but also from Christian Aid's own personal work, we were talking about our work on feminist alternatives to macroeconomic policies. And that's the kind of work that I'm really passionate about and trying to build up more in Christian Aid, to sort of see how gender justice intersects with Christian Aid priorities. So, you know, we have economic justice as one of our global policy and advocacy priority, and also climate justice. And so therefore, you know, how can we bring a feminist lens to our both EJ and, I mean, economic justice and climate justice work? So that's what the economic justice bit is what we were bringing to CSW in terms of why have the current macroeconomic policies failed to work for, say, the most marginalized or women living in poverty in different countries, and how can they be sort of reimagined from a completely different lens, which is, you know, where we actually look at people's well-being, where we try to sort of recognize the care roles that women and girls play and how they subsidize the economy. So, but they do not, their labor is not recognized and instead is appropriated by the state. So what are the alternative ways in which we can influence a different approach to the current, the dominant macroeconomic policy discourse? So that was one of the, that was basically what, you know, we were bringing to the CSW. But apart from that, I also took part in a in an event organized by ACT and the Church of Sweden in term on climate finance. And there, again, Christian Aid's attempt to sort of demonstrate how climate financing can be decentralized in a gender transformative manner. So again, you know, using our examples of our work in Bangladesh and sort of sharing about it to a wider audience to say that loss and damage is a reality for people in the most climate vulnerable countries such as Bangladesh. And so this is what we are doing, but also at the same time, we are putting money directly in the hands of the most kind of, you know, the most impacted groups, especially women, but also at the same time, we are working on ensuring that the gender norms are challenged and that women are able to, you know, enjoy control over the sort of the productive resources. So these were the, I mean, that in a nutshell kind of explains the work that I am doing in Christian Aid. And sort of, yeah, CSW was the place where I was trying to share some of that knowledge and reflections.
Now, thank you for sharing that experience that happened now a couple of weeks ago on the Commission on the Status of Women. And it's great to hear, you know, how Christian Aid and your work tries to connect, you know, the different events and activities, you know, so the issues that were discussed during the COP. So recently, you know, on climate, the fact that, you know, our planet is really under a lot of pressure, and but that how that all is related and interconnected. I really appreciate that. So, you know, Boshali, where I would like to go, and I know you're not a fan, but I still would like to go there, is, you know, another a framework that is of importance from my point of view are the Sustainable Development Goals. It's, you know, people have heard me say it's not perfect, but it's a framework we have, and I think it improved if you compare it to the Millennium Development Goals, because there was more participation, not perfect. So my question to my guest is, two questions. Are you familiar with the SDGs? And I know you are. But then what do you like to tell the listeners about the SDGs? And even if that is, you know, forget about it, because I think they are useless. Tell us, share about that.
No, I think, as you said, Maurice, they are kind of important because, of course, it's voluntary reporting, but still, you know, countries do report against how they have progressed, and that progress is measured every year. So, and of course, it comes from a place of good intentions in terms of, you know, getting all the countries in the world. I don't know how many of them are now, maybe 190 or something, but getting all of them to kind of agree and commit to a set of indicators is a mammoth achievement. So I do not want to downplay that. Of course, having said that, you cannot sort of, squeeze all of these problems into, you know, a set of indicators, etc. But at least, as you said, that gives some kind of a framework to measure how a particular country is doing on all of these aspects. In particular, I would say that for SDG 5, which is focused on gender equality, it's definitely an improvement on the MDGs. And it is also important that because of SDG 5, we now have a global commitment towards care work around sort of, you know, even to have care, questions of care and care work and redistribution of care work in the global sustainable goal agenda, I think has been a huge achievement by feminists. So I do see its importance, and I hope that there is sort of greater awareness and action towards their implementation. I wouldn't say that we need to forget them, but if countries have committed to it, then definitely I hope that, you know, we are taking more and more action, especially on SDG 5 and the ones around climate, because I think those are some of the ones on which the least amount of progress have been made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, on and the listeners know by now, I hope, that if we look at average, on average, we are stuck at 15% in terms of progress on the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. You know, a growing group of people around the world is saying that, you know, one of the reasons that we are not making the progress that we need to make, so, you know, those systems and process changes that are required, has to do is that we did not pay proper attention to the abilities, skills, and knowledge that you need as an individuals and as community as well. So they're saying, you know, you need to pay attention to those skill sets in terms of being, thinking, relating, collaborating, and acting. What is your first reaction if you hear me say that? That, you know, you can't do that work if you don't do self-work and also work as a community, you know, to work on those system changes that are required.
Yeah, I think from Christian Aid, I mean, I'm speaking on Christian Aid's behalf here. So I would say that we are always, from Christian Aid's perspective, we are always talking of structural changes and root causes, because we also understand that without that, and I would say that is probably where, you know, you always cannot boil down structural issues to a set of indicators. Probably that's where kind of some of the discomfort lies. But having said that, the question of structural sort of barriers is very, very important. And we also have to remember that when we talk of structures, there are, you know, certain structures that are present globally. So I would say the structure of the structure of patriarchy, the structure of the current economic model that's been really, really exploitative of nature and is kind of built on exploitation of natural resources, sort of the history of colonialism, the history of extractivism. So all of these structures, all of these systems have created structures that have, you know, created huge inequalities in the world. And even though there is now, especially thanks to Oxfam's work, there is now much more sort of discussion on inequalities. But the response to addressing inequalities has to come from a system of identifying what structures are preventing people from leading more equal lives, and equal lives in the sense of equality in all aspects. And then how do we dismantle those structures? And I think in terms of collaboration and the community work that you are doing, that you mentioned, I think here, sort of when we talk of dismantling structures, here the work of social movements and the work of feminist movements become really critical, because unless, you know, what you mentioned about sort of self-reflection, so unless, you know, people realize and then sort of get together in the form of a social movement to raise questions and then demand answers, till then, you know, any kind of big structural change is not likely to happen.
No, great. Thanks for that, Voshali. And you know, I would like to remind my listeners to check out the innerdevelopmentgoals.org, because I think they're trying to look at some of those things that you mentioned just now. You know, Voshali, the reason that I started this particular podcast is because, you know, in around 2012, I started to do a 100-mile walk to raise awareness and funds for hunger, poverty, and injustice. And then, you know, I would walk, or I walk 100 miles in a week, so 15 to 20 miles per day. And then during those walks, I would often be accompanied by guests who would walk with me a mile or 10 miles. But during COVID, I was not able to. I still walked, but I had to walk alone. So then I thought, okay, but how can I still connect with people? So I was thinking about this virtual walk, and you know, now we are close to no more than 200 episodes. Anyway, so my question to my guest is always, if you would be asked to walk 100 miles in a week, 15 to 20 miles a day, why would you do that? You know, what drives you?
Okay, so that's an interesting question. I generally like walking when there is sort of space available to walk, which is kind of rare in over urbanized cities like the ones we have in India. Why I would like to walk? I think walking is the best way that you can know a place. Walking kind of allows you to see things that you do not see if you're just passing by in a car or going by a train. So walking allows you to interact with your surroundings, which I think is really important. And it helps you to see, especially if you're working in the field of inequality, then walking really sort of exposes you to that. I think there's no better way to understand inequality unless you walk. And it can be in any country of the world. You walk and you see things that sort of help you understand. Like in New York, you know, you walk down Fifth Avenue and you'll have homeless people on one side, and you'll have all these, you know, big shiny shops. So I think, yeah, so walking really can educate you, I would say.
Great. You know, music is very dear to my heart, so I always ask a question about music as well. So if I ask you to come up to mention a song or a piece of music that embodies for a big part what you are about, which song or piece of music would that be and why?
Yeah, so I've already shared the link with you. It's from this Indian group, my favorite Indian band called Indian Ocean. And they are a sort of an alternative rock band. I probably that's what I can call them. It's a song called Ma Reva that talks about so Ma in the language means mother, and Reva is the name of the river, another river name for the river Narmada. So it's the river as the mother, which I think kind of exemplifies the relationship that a lot of cultures in the southern part of the world have with nature, where, you know, you have a very individualized personal relationship with nature. So the river is like your mother because the river gives you life. I think it's a folk song that they have sung. It's a beautiful song that pays tribute to the river, and it's also very beautifully sung and very catchy. It's the lyrics are wonderful, and it has this whole earthy feeling that I really like. And also because I have referred to climate justice as, you know, one of the areas of interest for me, and so I think, you know, the whole thing of the song kind of embodies for me my interest in the natural world, in the way we sort of do not, or we've kind of learned to ignore the living consciousness that is in the natural world, and the song kind of brings it back for me. So I suppose that's why it's I chose that song for you.
No, and I listened to it. You sent to me in advance, so thank you so much. And I also saw a live version of it. I will, you know, put the songs always in the podcast notes, and people can find it for themselves. And we made. I hope I can find a version on Spotify as well, so that it will be added to the special hashtag Walk Talk Listen. Playlist. Where all the songs that were picked by my guest can be listened to. But this song, it was also reminded me about, you know, life and as a circle or as a cycle when I was listening to that. What I resonate with as well is you referring to, you know, nature and Mother Nature. And I especially, you know, and rightly so, you alluded to the to climate justice. You know, now the discussions are coming up in a lot of places, the rights of nature as well. So that will really change the discussions and the actions. So that also rivers can go to court to demand for their rights. Yeah, so the song is great. So I would definitely advise people to check out that song. So thank you so much for sharing that. You know, here in the States, there is a guy, or yeah, it's not nice to say, a man named Steve Hartman of CBS. Who is still or was examining how one simple act of kindness potentially could create a ripple effect. So I have three small questions around this for you. First one is, what are your thoughts about, you know, the potential of one simple act of kindness in terms of replicating and rippling, causing a rippling effect? And then the second part of the question is, if I ask you to commit to one simple act of kindness this week, what would you do?
Yeah, no, I think it has huge potential, and I just wish we learn how to be kinder to each other, because I am also sort of hugely influenced by Bell Hooks's book, All About Love. And where she talks about sort of love as an alternative to the oppression, and sort of, you know, envisioning a different society that's based on love. And I think kindness is kind of an essential part of that. So I am all for a kinder society where we look out for each other. And the idea is to be there for each other, support, solidarity, and understanding. And not competition, which kind of seems to be the sort of the larger direction. In terms of the one act of kindness that I will know, I don't know if I'm planning to go out of my home this week because I work from home. So like, you know, Monday to Friday, I'm kind of just cooped up. So probably watering my plants so that they don't go thirsty, because in the very hot Bangalore summer right now, I don't know if that qualifies as an act of kindness, but yeah.
Well, in this, you know, within the context of what we just talked about, in, you know, taking care not only of humanity, but of all lives, it definitely fits. So, okay. Thanks for that. Do you have any message or an invitation or a question for the listeners?
Yeah, I think I did give that some thought. And I'm just trying to remember. Yeah, I think what I want to say is I was sort of trying to think through some great ending a line that kind of a catchphrase or something that will help me in my conversation. But I really, didn't have much time to think through it. I think I would say that we really need to believe in alternatives. And if we think that, there is this this thing we in the sense that, one has to challenge, but also at the same time, one has to create an alternative. And so I think the work of challenging and creating the work has to go hand in hand. And one cannot happen without the other not taking place. Because if we are saying that system is not working, then what is the alternative that we are offering? And there is a quote by Audre Lorde that I really like, that where she says that, we cannot use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. And I think that's really important, because it really makes you or forces you to think out of the box. That when we say that, this system is not working anymore for people and the planet, then what system can work and how can we work towards it? So I would say that dreaming about alternatives is really important, and of a more hopeful, kinder, more climate just future, where people are allowed to enjoy their basic, human dignity and freedom. So I think all of us need to work towards that kind of an alternative vision. Mm. So I would like to end with that.
Great. And thanks for that. So we, I think we have further tightened your relationships and connected you with the listeners. I would like to connect you also with the previous guest. And the previous guest has a question for you. And the question is,
so if this is a tug of war between misogyny and equality, what do you see as the best pathways forward?
Misogyny and equality, right?
Yeah,
I think I kind of answered that with what I said previously, that mm-hmm. obviously, misogyny is we do see that globally there is a sort of a backlash. There's an anti-gender movement, right? And ACT Alliance and partners are very kind of conscious and working towards that, towards challenging that. So there is a recognition that misogyny is not something that's dying down, but it keeps sort of rearing its head. Also probably as some form of a backlash from groups that feel that, they are losing their privileges. So there will be this whole tug of war that will continue to happen. Sometime we'll feel that misogyny is winning, but sometimes we'll also feel that there is still hope in terms of a more equitable future. So I think I would say it's important to sort of not give up hope, because I think history shows us that it has always been sort of the positive aspects, the progressive nature of thinking, of end of exploitative systems, end of regressive thinking, that ultimately has kind of won the tug of war. So I think I think one can hope. And of course, in that sense, I'm an optimist, because otherwise, we wouldn't be doing the work that we are doing, because all of us believe in ultimately making change happen. In the tug of war, I think the ultimate winner will be equality.
Bushali, your question for the next guest.
If you had a magic wand, my question for the next speaker is, if you had a magic wand and you could identify one thing that's currently missing from the world that you could sort of put back in, what would that be? Yeah.
Great. I would like to thank you for today's conversations and sharing your, who you are, your wisdom, your experience. Is there one question that I should have asked you, but I did not?
No, I think you were very comprehensive in a very short period of time. So yeah.
Great. Then I thank you so much and all the best with everything you do. And, yeah, and hopefully, thanks. You know, next thanks time so you're in New York, we can connect.
Yes, definitely. Next ASW. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Morris.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on 100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.